Blog Talk Radio.
Come on. Wake up, everybody.
creed of color. Everybody, we need each other. Wake up, everybody. Well, see, we need, wake up, everybody. We
come
need,
on, wake up, everybody. No more sleeping in there. No more backward thinking. Time for thinking ahead.
That's right. We want to wake up everybody. No more sleeping in the bed. We got so much work to do. We can't afford to be asleep. This is a special testing of MPH Radio. What you're going to hear from this program today, we're going to be testing out certain things. We're trying to be prepared for our official program, which will take place on July 1st, 2023 at 1 p.m. Right now, this is the 30th of June. We're trying to get our long-distance communication together. One of the issues we are just encountered, one of our guests has became sick, and we're going to have to make some adjustments starting tomorrow. But anyway, what we want you to do if you hear this program is to sit back. We're going to play some historical clippings for issues that are going on in our world, in our community. We want you to reflect and think about it, and you can respond back to us in writing by writing mphradio@yahoo.com and let us know what is your feeling towards some of the concerns that we will play today on this particular special testing program. The first one is titled, Why They Are Banning African History from the schools today. Sit back, listen, and write down your response and let us know.
Throughout the history of the United States, Black Americans suffered a multitude of atrocities, including widespread and brutal massacres that occurred across the country. These massacres, often fueled by racism and white supremacy, have resulted in the deaths of countless innocent Black men, women, and children. From the Tulsa Race Massacre of 1921 to the Move bombing in 1985, these horrific events have left deep scars on the Black community and serve as a painful reminder of the systemic oppression and violence we have faced for centuries. In this video, we will examine 10 of the most devastating incidents of violence against Black Americans throughout history. These massacres resulted in the loss of countless innocent lives and left deep wounds in the Black community. We must acknowledge and learn from these tragedies in order to move towards a more just and equitable society. Let's start off with the Atlanta Massacre. The 1880s marked a turning point for Atlanta, as the bustling city became the epicenter of the regional economy. With the influx of new residents, the city's population skyrocketed from 89,000 in 1900 to a staggering 150,000 by 1910. But with this growth came a host of challenges, including increased pressure on municipal services, job competition between Black and white workers, and rising class distinctions. In response, the city's white leadership implemented restrictions designed to control the behavior of the burgeoning working class, with mixed results. However, the social intermingling of the ensuing races was a cause for concern among the city's elite whites. This led to an expansion of Jim Crow segregation, particularly in the form of separating white and Black neighborhoods and establishing separate seating areas for public transportation. The Black population also grew significantly, from approximately 9,000 in 1880 to 35,000 by 1900, exacerbating tensions between the races. The emergence of a Black elite in Atlanta during Reconstruction led to increased racial tensions in the city. Black men gained the right to vote and began establishing businesses, social networks, and communities. However, as the Black elite gained wealth and prestige, they distanced themselves from the Black working class and saloon-goers, causing discomfort among some whites. Prohibition campaigns were launched against saloons, which were blamed for rising crime rates and threats of sexual violence against white women, further fueling racial tensions. The Atlanta Race Massacre of 1906 was sparked by sensationalized newspaper reports of the alleged rapes of four white women by Black men. The violence, which lasted from September 22nd to September 24th, resulted in the deaths of at least 25 Black people and two whites. Although unofficial reports suggest a higher death toll, Black Americans were hung, shot, beaten, and stabbed to death, and white mobs destroyed homes and businesses in Black neighborhoods. The violence only ended after the intervention of the Georgia National Guard, although accusations were made against some guardsmen and the Atlanta Police Department for participating in the violence. White historians largely ignored the massacre for decades, and it was not until 2006, on its 100th anniversary, that the event was publicly marked and later made part of the state's curriculum for public schools. But the gruesome killings of Black Americans didn't stop in 1906. Just 17 years after the Atlanta massacre, an even more traumatic event unfolded in Rosewood, a small town in Florida. In the early 1920s, the small town of Rosewood, Florida, was a thriving community of African Americans. Residents lived in relative peace and prosperity until a horrifying incident of racial violence turned their lives upside down. Everything changed on January 4, 1923, when rumors of an alleged attack by a Black man on a white woman sparked a wave of terror. Within hours, armed white mobs descended on the town, shooting at residents and burning buildings to the ground. As chaos reigned, some Rosewood residents fled to nearby swamps and sought refuge in the home of a white businessman, while others tried to fight back. One man, Sylvester Carrier, took up arms and engaged in a shootout that left two white men dead. The news of Carrier's retaliation quickly spread, and soon hundreds of white vigilantes joined the mob. The violence continued for 3 days, leaving almost all of Rosewood in ruins and its surviving residents fleeing for their lives. Despite a grand jury investigation, no one was held accountable for the atrocities committed against the Black neighborhood of Rosewood. What became known as the Rosewood Massacre of 1923 lasted several days, during which white mobs descended upon the predominantly African-American town, leaving a trail of destruction and death. The violence was so extreme that virtually every building in the town was burned to the ground, leaving a scar on the community that would last for decades. The official death toll of the Rosewood Massacre in 1923 may have been recorded as only 8 people, 6 Black and 2 white, but survivors' stories tell a different, much darker tale. Many claim that up to 27 Black residents were killed and that newspapers failed to report the true number of white deaths. Eyewitnesses have even spoken of a mass grave filled with Black bodies, covered with a plow brought in from Cedar Key. Despite these claims, authorities were unable to confirm them, as many of the witnesses were deceased or too frail to lead them to the alleged site. The Rosewood Massacre remained a buried chapter in history for over half a century until an investigative reporter named Gary Moore uncovered the horrific details in 1982. Survivors of the tragedy were finally able to tell their stories, leading to a renewed national interest in the incident. In 1994, the Florida legislature passed a bill to compensate the few remaining Rosewood victims for their losses, providing $150,000 in total. The tragic events of Rosewood were brought to a wider audience through the 1997 film Rosewood, directed by John Singleton. Yet again, it doesn't end here, as the series of events that led to the Springfield Massacre will leave you in greater shock. The Springfield Race Riot of 1908, also known as the Springfield Massacre, was a two-day riot in Springfield, Illinois, on August 14th and 15th, 1908. It was a violent and deadly event that had a profound impact on the city and its residents. The riot resulted in the deaths of both Black and white individuals, with estimates ranging from 5 to 40 deaths. It is said to have begun on August 14th, 1908, after two Black men, George Richardson and Joe James, were secretly moved out of jail to avoid a lynching by a white mob. The situation escalated when a white mob gathered outside the Sangamon County Jail and demanded that the two men be turned over to them. The mob, which numbered in the thousands, was outraged by the idea that the accused men would be given a fair trial, and they were determined to take matters into their own hands. After the mob had unleashed its anger on the homes of Black families in Springfield, they continued their violence in small communities beyond the city limits, specifically targeting stores with firearms and ammunition. The mob leaders gave careful instructions to the participants, directing them to destroy only homes and businesses owned by Black people and that served Black customers, while sparing nearby white establishments. As an act of self-defense, some Black residents in Springfield fought back by returning fire when they were attacked. Scott Burton, the first victim of the lynch mob, attempted to save his home and his life by using his shotgun. William Donegan, an 84-year-old cobbler, was the second victim lynched, allegedly due to his marriage to a white woman that had tainted his reputation in the eyes of the mob. The rioting continued for 2 days, and the white mob targeted Black businesses and homes, burning and looting them. The National Guard was called in to restore order. In the aftermath of the riot, many Black-owned homes, businesses, and churches were destroyed, causing property damage that amounted to over $150,000 in 1908. The destruction of property and the fear of further violence forced thousands of black residents to leave Springfield, with many never returning. The aftermath of the riot left 6 black people dead, 2 lynched, and hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of property destroyed. The violence also caused approximately 2,000 black people to be driven out of Springfield. The Springfield Race Riot was a turning point in the fight for civil rights in the United States. As it highlighted the deep racial tensions and discrimination in American society at the time, it also led to the formation of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, which was established in 1909 in response to the riot and other incidents of racial violence. The Springfield Massacre is now recognized as a significant event in the history of the civil rights movement. And 2 years after the Springfield Massacre, there was a harrowing series of events that led to the killing of African Americans by white supremacists in Slocum. The Slocum Massacre of 1910 was a tragic event that took place in Slocum, Texas, United States. It was a brutal racial massacre targeted at blacks and resulted in the deaths of a larger number of African Americans. The incident is often referred to as the worst racial massacre in Texas history. Slocum was a small town in East Texas, with a population of over 400 people, half of which was African Americans. The town was located in an area with a history of racial tensions and violence, and many white residents were members of the Ku Klux Klan. Prior to the massacre, a lynching of a black man in the nearby Cherokee County ignited racial tensions in the Slocum area. White rumors spread that black residents had been gathering in Slocum to plan an armed uprising. The tensions further escalated when a white man attempted to collect a disputed debt from a well-respected black farmer named Abe Wilson, and even worsened when an African American was put in charge of soliciting aid for road improvements by a road construction foreman. A confrontation ensued, enraging Jim Sperger, a local white farmer, who emerged as the primary instigator of the conflict that led to the massacre. Numerous newspapers and eyewitness accounts documented that Sperger initiated the events by alleging that blacks had threatened him. Fueled by Sperger and other white vigilantes, a furious mob consisting of heavily armed white men from various parts of Anderson County rampaged through Slocum in multiple groups. According to certain accounts, up to 200 men laid siege to the town, indiscriminately firing their guns at black residents. As survivors of the carnage spread the word, African Americans fled in terror. The white mobs pursued the fleeing blacks into the nearby forests and marshes, shooting them in the back. All initial newspaper reports depicted African Americans as armed instigators, which were severe distortions of the truth. Newspapers initially reported 8 to 22 deaths of black residents, but the black community claimed a minimum of 40 and potentially over 200 victims. The Anderson County Sheriff, William H. Black, found it challenging to determine the exact death toll due to the scattered bodies in the woods. Many black residents fled during and after the massacre, abandoning their assets to save their lives. White residents later seized their properties, such as Jack Holly's dairy, granary, general store, and 700 acres of land, after he and his family escaped the town. The Slocum Massacre of 1910 is a reminder that the fight for equality and justice is historic, and that we must continue to work towards a more just and equitable society for all Americans. And as black Americans strive for economic prosperity and improved welfare in Thibodaux, their efforts are faced with the most shocking form of opposition. Before we get into it, please hit the like button and subscribe to the channel. It goes a long way in helping our message get pushed out to more people. Thank you for the support. Now let's move on to the next massacre. On November 23, 1887, black sugarcane workers in Thibodaux, Louisiana, sought to unionize and demand fair wages during the crucial harvest season. However, their peaceful protest ended in tragedy. These workers endured harsh conditions, long hours, and meager pay, with scripts that could only be used at plantation stores. The Knights of Labor, one of the few unions that organized black workers, encouraged the sugar cutters to demand $1.25 a day in cash. Despite unsuccessful attempts in the past, the cutters believed they could succeed during the rolling season when planter demands for workers was high. Junius Bailey, a 29-year-old schoolteacher and union leader, negotiated with growers for better conditions, but the negotiations failed and somehow resulted in a violent massacre. On November 22nd, when the growers refused to negotiate and terminated the union members, the workers called a strike. For the next 3 weeks, approximately 10,000 laborers, the largest farming industry strike, refused to work, affecting LaForche, Terrebonne, St. Mary, and Assumption parishes. In the meantime, white vigilantes restricted Thibodeau, seeking to identify strikers and demanding passes from any black individuals entering or leaving town. As morning broke on November 23rd, gunfire erupted from the cornfield, injuring two white guards, a sad event which triggered the beginning of the massacre. The planters convinced former sugar planter and Democratic governor Samuel B. McHenry to deploy several units of the all-white state militia. The militia, commanded by ex-Confederate General P.G.T. Beauregard, brought a .45 caliber Gatling gun, while the paramilitary groups positioned themselves outside the Thibodeau courthouse. Both the militia and white vigilantes indiscriminately shot suspected strikers and any black people who crossed their path. Approximately 60 people were killed indiscriminately, with many of the strikers' bodies being discarded in unmarked graves. The killings continued to spread to other plantations, causing those who survived to hide in the woods and swamps. Despite being one of the deadliest events in U.S. labor history, the Southern white press praised the actions of the militia and vigilantes during the Thibodeau massacre. Andrew Price, a sugar planter who participated in the attacks, even won a seat in Congress in 1888. Many of those involved in the unlawful killings were honored with statues and public areas named after them, while the workers, including women and children, remained anonymous, with their murders only recognized by their loved ones. It wasn't until the 1930s that black farm workers made another serious attempt at unionizing. Decades of sugar worker organizing came to an end after the massacre and the enactment of discriminatory state laws by white Democrats, which included the disenfranchisement of most black people. According to the historian John C. Rodrigue, defeated sugar workers were forced to return to the plantations on their employers' terms. This state of affairs persisted until the 1940s. Unfair, you will say, but the numbers keep increasing as we look at the massacre in Colfax, a small town in Louisiana. On April 13, 1873, the small town of Colfax, Louisiana, was the site of a battle-turned massacre between black and white residents. Approximately 150 black people and three white people were killed in the conflict. The massacre occurred in the aftermath of the highly contested Louisiana governor's race of 1872, which was won narrowly by the Republicans. Despite their victory, white Democrats were incensed and sought revenge. In Colfax Parish and other parts of the state, they organized a white militia to directly challenge the predominantly black state militia under the governor's control. Colfax Parish was emblematic of the political and racial divide in Louisiana at the time. The 4,600 voters in the 1872 election were split between approximately 2,400 mostly black Republican voters and 2,200 white Democratic voters. However, a specific incident sparked the Colfax massacre. On March 28th, local white Democratic leaders called for armed supporters to help them take the Colfax Parish courthouse from GOP office holders, who were predominantly black. The Republicans urged their supporters, who were also mostly black, to defend them. Although nothing happened on April 1st, fighting erupted between the two groups on the following day. On Easter Sunday, April 13th, more than 300 armed white men, including members of the white supremacist organizations, such as the Knights of White Camellia and the Ku Klux Klan, attacked the courthouse. When the white militia maneuvered a cannon to fire on the courthouse, some of the 60 black defenders fled, while others surrendered. The leaders of the attackers, James Hadnott, was accidentally shot by one of his own men, prompting the white militia to retaliate by shooting the black prisoners. Those who were wounded in the earlier battle, especially black militia members, were singled out for execution. The indiscriminate killing spread to African Americans, who had not been at the courthouse, and continued throughout the night. In total, around 150 African Americans were killed, with 48 being murdered after the initial battle. Only three whites were killed, and few were injured in the largely one-sided Battle of Colfax. After the massacre, the state militia under the control of Republican Governor William Kellogg arrived on April 14th and documented the violence. New Orleans police and federal troops also arrived in the following days to restore order. A total of 97 white militiamen were apprehended and charged with violating the U.S. Enforcement Act of 1870, also called the Ku Klux Klan Act. While a few were found guilty, they were eventually released in 1875 when the U.S. Supreme Court declared the Enforcement Act unconstitutional. However, no one was ever apprehended by the state of Louisiana or by intimidated local officials. And while this is gruesome, the massacre of East St. Louis indicates that there may have been some organized efforts in America to take out the black communities or silence their voices. In the early summer of 1917, East St. Louis, Illinois, was the scene of one of the most brutal and devastating racial attacks in U.S. history. Between 1916 and 1917, around 10,000 to 12,000 African Americans migrated to East St. Louis, Illinois, attracted by job prospects in the wartime industries. This influx of black workers into the city's industrial plants caused discomfort among many previously white residents who were not used to such a diverse population. What began as a series of labor disputes quickly escalated into a violent rampage as white Americans unleashed their fury on the city's black community. Over the course of several days, between 39 and 150 African Americans were brutally murdered, while another 6,000 were left homeless. The destruction of property was also significant, with an estimated $400,000 in damages, $8.46 million in 2021. The riots were so severe that they have been described as the worst case of labor-related violence in 20th century American history, and among the worst racial riots in U.S. history. The brutality of the violence was even more disturbing, as it happened soon after America's involvement in World War I. In the words of historian Winston James, in April, black soldiers were sent to fight for democracy, and in July, black individuals were brutally killed in East St. Louis. Children were thrown into burning homes. People were trapped in their homes before being set on fire, and it was a horrific event, even by American standards. In the aftermath, the city was left in shambles, and many black citizens left the city permanently. Despite the widespread destruction, the rioting was largely unchecked by local law enforcement, and the East St. Louis Chamber of Commerce called for the resignation of the police chief. The tragedy sparked a wave of protests across the country, with 10,000 black citizens marching in silent protest in New York City in condemnation of the violence. The government's reaction to the East St. Louis massacre was inadequate and disappointing. Although President Woodrow Wilson expressed his condolences, he did not take any concrete action to address the situation. He refused to meet with a delegation of black leaders who requested a meeting to discuss the issue. Additionally, the Illinois National Guard, responsible for maintaining order in the city, failed to protect black residents from the violence. Overall, the government's response demonstrated a lack of concern for the well-being of black individuals and a failure to uphold their rights as citizens. You may think this is upsetting until you realize how police officers rained down bombs on black residents in Philadelphia. In 1985, the Philadelphia Police Department engaged in a confrontation with the Black Liberation Move organization, resulting in the destruction of residential homes in the Cobbs Creek neighborhood of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, United States. In a show of force, on May 13, 1985, approximately 500 police officers, led by City Manager Leo Brooks, attempted to remove Move members from a building and execute arrest warrants. To make the occupants leave, authorities shut off the water and electricity. At 5:35 a.m., Commissioner Sam Burr delivered a speech to Move members, giving them 15 minutes to exit the premises. When the group refused to comply, the police reported to dropping a bomb on the building, where 7 adults and 6 children were present. During the 90-minute long standoff, Move members fired at police officers, who retaliated with tear gas and both semi-automatic and automatic firearms. Using over 10,000 rounds of ammunition, one officer was struck in the back, but not severely injured. Finally, at 2 p.m., Commissioner Sambor ordered the bombing of the compound. While aboard a Pennsylvania State Police helicopter, Lieutenant Frank Powell of the Philadelphia Police Department dropped 2 bombs made of Tovex, a dynamite substitute, along with 2 pounds of C4, provided by the FBI, onto a fortified bunker-like cubicle on the roof of the house occupied by MOVE members. The police referred to these bombs as entry devices. The bombs detonated after 45 seconds, causing the gasoline-powered generator to ignite and starting a fire that engulfed the house. Authorities claim that this was a tactical move intended to burn through the roof and destroy the bunker so that tear gas could be deployed into the house to force out the occupants. Firefighters arrived on the scene 30 minutes later, but were met with gunfire, causing them and police officers to retreat as the fire spread to neighboring houses. Only 2 MOVE members, Bertie Africa, who was 13 years old at the time, and Ramona Africa, managed to escape the burning building. Initially, police claimed that 2 men had also fled the house and fired at them, prompting a return of fire. However, Ramona Africa disputed this account, alleging that police had opened fire on those attempting to flee. The police countered by claiming that MOVE members had been shooting at them while moving in and out of the house. The fire department ultimately brought the blaze under control at 11:47 p.m. Tragically, the fire that resulted from the bombing claimed the lives of 11 MOVE members, including 6 adults and 5 children: John Africa, Rhonda Africa, Teresa Africa, Frank Africa, Conrad Africa, Tree Africa, Delicia Africa, Netta Africa, Little Phil Africa, Tommaso Africa, and Raymond Africa. Additionally, the fire destroyed 61 neighboring homes, leaving approximately 250 individuals without a place to live. And while this was terrible, The Elaine Massacre is a crazy occurrence that remains a scar in the annals of time in black history. The year was 1919, and tensions were running high in rural Phillips County, Arkansas. Phillips County, Arkansas was once a hub for cotton plantations, with enslaved African Americans working the land before the Civil War. Even in the early 20th century, the county's population was still predominantly black, with many of them working as illiterate farm laborers and sharecroppers. Despite the high number of African Americans in the community, the white landowners controlled the economy, creating a system that heavily favored them. White plantation owners sold cotton on their own schedule, controlled high-priced plantation stores, and settled accounts with sharecroppers in lump sums, without listing items. The Elaine Massacre was a culmination of various factors, including a long history of racial tension and discrimination in Arkansas, economic exploitation of black sharecroppers, and fears of the growth of labor unions among African-American farmers. In 1919, a group of black sharecroppers organized themselves into the Progressive Farmers and Household Union in order to improve their living and working conditions. However, this was viewed as a threat by white plantation owners and businessmen who controlled the area's economy and political power. On the night of September 30, 1919, a group of black farmers met in a church near Elaine to discuss how to gain fair prices for their crops. A group of white men, who feared that the meeting was actually a gathering of black militants planning an insurrection, interrupted the meeting and a shootout ensued. Over the next several days, white mobs, including law enforcement officials and vigilantes, descended on the area and indiscriminately attacked black residents, including women and children. Reports vary, but it is estimated that anywhere from 100 to 800 African Americans were killed. Five white people also lost their lives during the violence. The massacre was followed by a wave of arrests and trials of black residents, many of whom were falsely accused of participating in an insurrection. The white mobs responsible for the massacre were aided by federal troops and local terrorist organizations, with the Arkansas governor leading a contingent of over 500 U.S. soldiers. The Elaine Massacre was the deadliest racial confrontation in Arkansas history, and one of the bloodiest in the history of the United States. But not only was this allowed to go down in history unchecked, but the hatred for blacks also continued to spread across the country. In 1921, African Americans had to deal with more trouble than racial and economic segregation somewhere in Tulsa, Oklahoma. In the aftermath of slavery, a glimmer of hope emerged in Tulsa, Oklahoma's Greenwood District, dubbed the Black Wall Street. Purchased in 1906 by wealthy black landowner O.W. Gurley, the area provided a sanctuary for formerly enslaved black people and sharecroppers fleeing from the racial terror that plagued other regions. The thriving community was home to successful black entrepreneurs, homeowners, and civic leaders who defied societal odds and flourished in their own right. But this progress was short-lived, as a horrific event would soon shatter the dreams and aspirations of the black community in Greenwood. On May 31st, 1921, everything changed. The Greenwood District of Tulsa was ravaged by a brutal and devastating race massacre, leaving dozens of black residents dead and thousands homeless. The massacre began when a young black man named Dick Rowland was accused of assaulting a white woman in an elevator, sparking tensions, simmering for years in a city deeply divided along racial lines. Despite no evidence of assault, Rowland was arrested and placed in the Tulsa jail. As rumors of an impending lynching of Rowland spread, a group of armed black men went to the courthouse to protect him. A white mob met them, and a confrontation ensued. Shots were fired, and chaos erupted. The black men retreated to the Greenwood District, but the white mob followed, burning and looting homes and businesses in the area. The National Guard was called in, but instead of protecting the black community, they assisted the white mob in their destruction of the Greenwood District. Planes were even used to drop bombs on the area, causing widespread destruction and death. As the violence continued for 18 hours, an estimated 300 people lost their lives within the district's 35 square blocks, more than 1,200 homes, at least 60 businesses, dozens of churches, a school, a hospital, and a public library were reduced to ashes and rubble. These staggering figures were revealed in a report by Human Rights Watch documenting the sheer magnitude of the destruction wrought upon the once flourishing Greenwood District during the Tulsa Massacre. The aftermath of the massacre was just as harrowing as the event itself. While the estimated damages totaled $1.4 million, experts suggest it underestimated the true cost. Survivors, many of whom lost their homes and businesses, never received government assistance or restitution for their losses. The impact of the massacre was felt for generations to come. The Tulsa Massacre was a horrific event in American history, and its impact on the black community in Tulsa was felt for decades. It serves as a painful reminder of the deep-seated racism and violence that has plagued America for far too long. Thanks for watching today's documentary. We aren't just telling stories. We're changing lives and waking the culture up. Like and subscribe to the channel to join the movement.
brothers, let's do it together. Come on, sisters, the sea's our home. We've got different voices and philosophy, and that's why we need harmony. Yeah, the soul of Africa. Beauty come to life. It's time to leave the past. Let's go die.
Black and proud, and that's who we are.
We are Africa, oh. Our pride and motherland. May the labor of our fathers not be in vain. We're Africa, we're black and proud, and that's who we
Africa was never disadvantaged. She just never used her advantage.
We welcome you back to MPH Radio. It's June the 30th, Friday, the last Friday of the month. We're doing a special program and seeking your support for MPH Radio. We are using history as a tool to help liberate our communities. Throughout this special program, you'll be hearing different historical documentaries of history that they don't want to teach in schools, but we will teach it on MPH Radio. So support our noble cause, support our radio station, and support the movement of learning African history by making a generous contribution by either you can sell it to Missing Pages of History 1 at yahoo.com, or you can put a check or money order to P.O. Box 27782, Richmond, Virginia, 23261, to Missing Pages of History, Inc. That's right, Missing Pages of History, Inc., P.O. Box 27782, Richmond, Virginia, 23261. And if those methods doesn't allow you to make your contribution, please email us at mphradio@yahoo.com, and we will share with you other alternatives where you can make your contribution to help us continue to move forward as we attempt to preserve, to create, and to document, and to share the history of African people and their contribution to humanity. So what we're going to do right now, we can go to another documentary. And this documentary is titled, Why the West Want Africa Poor. That's right. Why the West Want Africa Poor. We often say that Africa is not poor. African people are not poor. They are just poorly organized. So we want you to take out your pen and paper, take some notes, call your children, and tell them, gather around and listen to this particular documentary. This is Alan Hemingway, but trying to make Alan's small contribution to our people and world humanity. This is MPH. Please get out and take out of your pocket and make a contribution to this noble cause and support the station. And by the way, we'll be on live tomorrow, July the 1st, 1 p.m. And we have an interesting topic we can discuss. And this theme, the theme of this topic will be, and check this out, a message, a special message to the African community. You want to hear this message, please tune in tomorrow at 1 p.m. MPH Radio. So let's go to this next documentary. And don't forget, while you're listening, take out that checkbook, put that pen on a piece of paper, and make a contribution to MPH Radio. This one is Why the West Wants Africa to Be Poor.
Designed to say is this. Africa historically, sub-Saharan Africa, has been fundamental to the global prosperity of the advanced countries. Okay? And Africa had a role to play. It has a role as a raw material producer. We will not allow sub-Saharan Africa to escape that. Okay, we do everything to keep sub-Saharan Africa where it is, also impoverished. It's absolutely vital for the prosperity of everyone else. So let's get clear about that. Okay, and this means all the economic structures, all the global institutions, and the economics we teach everyone is all designed to keep Africa exactly where it is. And whether it is Europe or US or now China, it's always the same. We need Africa to be impoverished because we need those raw materials and we need them dirt cheap. Okay, so that's the message. It doesn't mean to say that there's nothing Africans can do. Of course there is. Okay, but this is the opposition that they're fighting. This is what it's about. Because if Africa does do something different, I assure you living standards of all those in Europe and North America and Asia is going to fall. Okay? And that is a big price to pay. I assure you that the West is not going to allow that without a big fight. Okay? So this is what it's fundamentally about. What I want to show you is how these structures are operating. It's just 20 minutes, so we can't do very much, but just to give you a little bit of an idea And why I keep the ideology part there is because we are part of the producers of ideology. At universities and academic institutions, we are complicit in this whole enterprise. Okay, so the job of many Western academics is to convince Africans they have to keep doing what they're doing. Okay, and to show them it's your fault that you're poor. It's not our fault. It's your fault that you're poor. You know, so this is what we do in academic institutions, and I want to show that as well. In the start, this is what it's basically about, so you know what it's about, but I want to just show you the extent to which Africa is specializing in the production of raw materials and basic agricultural goods. We know the basic forces that have caused this underdevelopment. We know it's colonization. I will not discuss that very much because my colleague speaker is going to go into some aspects of this. But I do want to discuss the global economic structures, the global financial institutions, and economic ideology, briefly, to give you a flavor of those. Let me start with this. You can't really see it so easily, but if those of you who are interested, you want the PowerPoint, I'm sure we can make it available to you. But the thing that you really need to see, the top line, okay? And the extent of dependency is captured by this statistic at the top, okay? And you compare it with all other income groups, and what you see is essentially in that one statistic how dependent sub-Saharan Africa is on raw material production. Okay, this is the very heart of what makes sub-Saharan Africa beat. Okay, here, just to have a look at one very important additional statistic, with all this export coming from sub-Saharan Africa, how much does sub-Saharan Africa account for in terms of global trade value? We know there's vast resources coming from there, but look at the bottom line in terms of global trade value. Look at that. 0.5% 1975, 0.95%, going down to 0.1, meaning that with all these vast resources being produced, how much are they getting for it? Nothing. This is a very significant piece of data. Then I just want to show you what has happened to sub-Saharan Africa, because what we know, and from all studies, no country ever develops without manufacturing. Okay, producing raw materials will not take you anywhere. Producing basic agricultural goods will not take you anywhere. And let's have a look at how much manufacturing activity takes place in sub-Saharan Africa. We can look over the last 15, 20 years. And we see manufacturing has actually declined as a percentage of the total. This is percentages of total production in sub-Saharan Africa. How much of it is accounted for by manufacturing? So this figure here is 17% of the total. Most of the rest, when we talk of industry, it includes manufacturing, but the bulk of it is mining. Okay? Raw material extraction. This is the bulk of it. And here we see actually raw material extraction has stayed the same. What has caused industry to fall is the fall in manufacturing production. This is deliberate because we will never, as Western economists, as Western policymakers, we cannot afford to allow Africa to industrialize and start producing manufactures. Okay, so we will do everything to stop that. And I'm going to show you how we actually block that. It's obvious in certain ways, but it's less obvious in other ways. Now, we have actually seen periods of rapid growth in sub-Saharan Africa, misleading people, saying, oh, you know, we're now doing much better. And this has happened recently. Recently, I've had students come and tell me, we've done much better now. And you can see growth rates rose quite sharply in recent times. Now are starting to go again down. But if you look historically, the same thing happened earlier. Why? Because in these two periods, we had East Asian rapid industrialization processes. So in the earlier period, we had Japan and Korea and Taiwan. Okay, rapid growth, sucking in raw materials from Africa, driving up the prices, and then sub-Saharan African countries grew. Exporting raw materials, they grew. But after those countries finished industrialization, then sub-Saharan African growth rate again fell. Okay, but along comes China. Next wave. Okay, again, sub-Saharan African growth rises, but now China is going down. As many of you now know from the press, China is going down. But sub-Saharan Africa is going down even faster. And we're going to go back to where we were again with very low prices of raw materials, very low growth rates, and again the sort of poverty that we saw once before. Because, bottom line, sub-Saharan Africa is condemned to this role. Just the supplier of raw materials, not a manufacturer. Very recent data showing emerging markets that produce raw materials against emerging markets that produce manufactures. And you can see now with the weakness in the global economy, it's the emerging markets, that's the red line, it's those countries that are suffering the most, the emerging markets producing raw materials. They're suffering the most. And here, it translates into their currencies being butchered. Okay? The currencies are collapsing of these countries, and many of them are sub-Saharan African countries. Some of them are Latin American countries, okay, who also rode that same wave. They thought that raw material production was going to save them. But now they're facing terrible problems. And I'm sorry to say, it's just going to get worse in the next 2 years. It's not going to get any better. And this is what it does in terms of gross domestic product. It's the blue line you should look at. It's the blue line compared with the red line. And what we know is that blue line is really going to go down sharply in the next 2 years. Okay, so relative to the rest of the world, sub-Saharan Africa is going to suffer. Again, why? Because it's condemned to this raw material production. This is basically why. How is it condemned to that? Well, the first and most important is the economic structures. After colonization ended, we needed new structures to keep these countries where they were. Okay? And the first of those is aid. Okay? We give them aid. Aid for what? Actually, we give them aid to keep repressive regimes in power. That's all. Okay, we're not giving them aid for much more except a little bit of infrastructure to make sure those raw materials get to the ports and aren't gotten out of the ground. But for the most part, we give repressive regimes money and power and guns to keep that system going. This is what it's fundamentally about. All the hypocrisy about transparency and democracy and bullshit like that, it's all bullshit. You know? And at least the Chinese don't enter into that bullshit. They say, we don't care about the whole political environment, we just give the money. Okay? And it's for raw material extraction, period. Okay. Number two, and this was a very important one, still is, debt. I was telling some of my students today, was it today or yesterday, about Confessions of an Economic Hitman. Do you remember this? Have any of you heard of this one? Confessions of an Economic Hitman. It's a book written by John Perkins, who used to work for a very nebulous, opaque bank. No one had ever heard of this bank, but it was formed in the 1950s by the IMF, the CIA, and the American State Department. And it had only one job, to lend money to developing countries that were raw material producers in order to indebt them. Once you are in my debt, I control you. Okay? And this bank had 4,000 employees, but no one ever heard of this bank, you see. But it would go to country after country offering loans. And if the president did not accept the loan, they were killed. And he gives two examples of presidents who were killed when they did not accept the loan. You see, the lending is also very important to trap the country. It's very important. It's part of that process. I teach in Suriname. And Suriname in recent times had a huge foreign exchange reserve, so big they didn't need to borrow money. And then one of my students, who was very high up in government, he said, you know, the IMF is trying to convince us to borrow money from foreigners. Why? I thought, duh, you know, sorry about this, but, you know, this is the game. And in the end, Suriname did borrow this money because the IMF said, if foreigners lend to you, then everyone will think Suriname is such a strong economy that foreigners are interested in lending to you. You understand? Before Lula came to power, you know, the previous president in Brazil, Cardoso, his predecessor, took a gigantic international loan. No necessity for taking the loan. Why? Because once I catch you with the debt strings, I hold you forever. You are my prisoner. Okay, so debt has been this huge spider's web which has trapped sub-Saharan Africa and keeps them held there. Aid, debt. We have a third structure which is again not known by many people, but it's something that was put in place and continues to this very day. With no one discussing it, no one says anything about it, it is monopoly buying structures. This is for all raw materials and basic agricultural goods produced by developing countries. There are only four or five Western multinationals that buy all those goods. And they collude between them. So if you take any major product, these Western multinationals, they collude between them. Even if we go down to banana production, we had a PhD done here at the ISS, and the person showed that the four or five major multinationals, they collude, and in order to make sure their control is total, what they do is they force all the producers to produce the same uniform banana. You know, the crap you buy in the West and has no taste at all? You go to any developing country, you know how a banana tastes, don't you? There's so many of them, lots of varieties, but we only market one or two types, so we have control, you see. If you don't produce at the price I want you to produce, I go to the next country. You see, we get control. So these buyers, they impose that control, and they keep pushing the prices down, and down, and down. Okay, this is the game. No one says anything about it. There are no commissions of inquiry to say, this is illegal what you're doing. The WTO has nothing to say about this. But sorry to say, you know, if banana prices rose 10 times, especially for people like me who love bananas, okay, I protest. I like my living standards. Okay, it's the same with all the other raw materials, you see. We're all benefiting. We're complicit. We're actually complicit in this because we will protest and shout out if the situation ever changed. Okay, now we come to those international institutions. And I must tell you this, from the outset, don't think of them as wicked. IMF, World Bank, WTO. We always think evil creatures, horrible. It's not. It's just economics. It's economic warfare. The rich declare war on the poor. It happens everywhere. It happens in a country. The rich control the government. Of course they do. You really believe you have democracy? Come on. You know, I mean, grow up. This is not about people living in democratic systems. What we have is the rich control. The rich set up these institutions explicitly to control the poor countries. And they don't give them much room for maneuver. Which incidentally, when the IMF starts talking of poverty alleviation, you should also understand that there's another game they're also starting to play, which I'm going to come back to later. But what do these institutions do? What does the IMF do? What is structural adjustment about? It's about making sure countries keep producing what we want them to produce. We make sure they have recurrent balance of payments problems. You notice these countries never get out of balance of payments problems. You notice that? Whereas countries that never took IMF support are always out of balance of payments problems. But the countries that are continuously getting advice and support by the IMF, they're always in balance of payments problems. Why? Because that's the way we keep our stranglehold on them. And that's what we have done. We have done, the IMF and the World Bank. And they've also done something very, very important. And that is they have destroyed the self-sufficiency of these countries. Colonization started it. Okay, one of the most important things is we destroy food self-sufficiency. Okay, and the World Bank continued it. They forced most countries to eliminate all food subsidies and food support. Okay, because once you don't produce your own food, I increase my control over it. How do we know this? Well, very funny thing happened some years ago. Not so funny, actually. It involved starvation of a large number of people in Malawi. Okay. Many of you could remember this because it was really tragic. But the Malawian finance minister, who was under terrible threat at the time, suddenly broke ranks and he said, well, you know why we had this famine? Because one of the conditions of the loan given by the World Bank was we destroyed all our grain surplus stocks. Why? Because remember, we want you dependent. 1970s, the US Senate, the US Congress said, we will not allow Latin America to produce their own food. We will start a strategy involving the IMF and the World Bank to destroy food self-sufficiency of Latin America. Then they will indeed be our true backyard. And that's exactly what they have done. Look at all the Latin American countries. Look at them. They used to be food self-sufficient, but they are no longer food self-sufficient. Now here comes the kicker. This is the beautiful part of it. I congratulate them. You know I admire them because they do it so well. Okay? I know it sounds really perverse. But we have now in the WTO something called the Agreement on Agriculture. Okay? You know what that Agreement on Agriculture states? It says, if you don't have any subsidies, you're not allowed to put these subsidies on food. But if you have subsidies and income support for food production, you can keep them. Who has all the subsidies and income support? US, Europe. The largest budgets in the world for supporting their farmers are Europe and US. But the World Bank and IMF have destroyed all those subsidies. You see, all those subsidies have been destroyed. And now we're telling these countries, you don't have subsidies, tough luck, you know. You see, we're keeping them dependent. We're keeping them on a string. I have 5 minutes, so I have to be choosy about what I say next. We have lots of examples in the WTO to really stop Africa industrializing. This is the crucial thing. We cannot allow them to produce manufacturers. It's not difficult. Trust me, it's not difficult. We need nationalist governments. We need them committed to industrialization, and it won't take them a decade to move out from where they are. This is the fundamental point. It's not difficult. But this next round of the WTO is designed to block that. If we had time, I would go through all the different things that they're trying to put into place to block anyone else getting on top of the ladder. You've read this book of Hajun Chang, Kicking Away the Ladder. You see, when we become rich, we make sure the others can't climb up the ladder and join us. Okay? And this is what this next Doha round is about. It's to make sure, especially sub-Saharan African countries, do not escape. Since I have about 3 minutes left, I'm going to go to this economic ideology thing, because this is important for academics. You see, we teach, in many cases, garbage. And it doesn't hurt anyone, a lot of this garbage. You know, it's a blah, 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 blah. And we don't know what we have learned, but anyway, we were there at the university and you got a certificate and you go away and you feel you've learned something. But sometimes we teach very destructive things. And no more important than when we're teaching people from developing countries. Okay, and one of those very damaging and destructive things is the doctrine of comparative advantage. It's a lie from beginning to end. It's utter crap. It has been decimated many times, but we keep it in every curriculum. Why? Because it tells sub-Saharan African countries that their destiny is to produce raw materials, you see. And if you produce raw materials, you get rich just like we are in the West. You see, this is the game we're playing, and just for you to be totally confused, we normally build models with it, mathematical models, so you really have no idea what we're talking about. But it seems all very scientific. Then we have the modern version of this is because it's all a failure, we know it's a failure, we now have a new generation of economists saying, it's only a failure because you're all corrupt in your countries. We call that new institutional economics. You've all probably learnt it all, but you didn't know why they invented it. It was invented to tell you the same thing. You should keep producing raw materials. Now, don't be as corrupt as you were before. Nobody ever told you that aid was designed to actually start the corruption process in the first place. Okay, and we need corruption to make sure you're doing all these things. But now we blame the victim. You're poor because it's your fault, basically. And you're poor, stupid, and corrupt, basically. This is the message that we're giving people. We also have many theoretical justifications, but I'm going to say something controversial to end. And she's happy that I'm ending because she has to discipline me. And that is, there are also what I call more enlightened approaches, but which are also potentially destructive for sub-Saharan African development. And this is where I come back to the IMF and the World Bank. You see, now they're all into poverty alleviation. They want you to concentrate on redistributing income, and it's something nice. You're young people, you're socially conscious, you're aware. You don't like all this injustice. So you gravitate towards what we call pro-poor strategies. But actually, I'm sorry to tell you, that is not what Africa needs. Africa needs aggressive industrialization. When China was a communist country and we had equal distribution, who feared China? Who took them seriously? They weren't even the size of the Netherlands. But today, I can't open an internet site. I can't open a magazine. I can't open a newspaper without China, 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 China. And we know what has built China. It's not socialism or communism. It's capitalism, guys. It's manufacturing. It's production. This is what creates employment. This is what creates jobs. I'm not pro-capitalist, but this is the reality. And unfortunately, we're now going to get caught with the good cop, bad cop. The good cop is now IMF saying, oh, you must concentrate on poverty reduction and income redistribution. As long as we can take you away from industrialization. This is the crucial thing. You know? I leave it at that. And I'm sorry I took so much.
Take it.
We'd like to welcome you back to MPH Radio. You're listening to the voice of Missing Pages of History Radio. As we continue down the road of liberation by understanding that if we don't learn to teach our history, then who will? This is a special program where we share with our community and the rest of humanity some of the history and struggles of African people. I hope so far you have enjoyed the listenings of the various documentaries that has been presented to you. And like we say, if they don't teach you in the schools, MPH Radio will. Along with that, we'd like to remind you, this is a special program. We are calling out for your support. You can support MPH Radio by making a generous contribution by either zelling it. You can zell it to Missing Page of History 1 at Yahoo. Or you can write a check or a money order. You can send a check or a money order at P.O. Box 27782, Richmond, Virginia 23261. Again, we're sorry for the confusion here, but again, you can make your donation check out to Missing Pages of History, Inc., P.O. Box 27782, Richmond, Virginia 23261. We would greatly appreciate it, and we'd like to remind you, tomorrow, July the 1st at 1 p.m., we will have our regular program, which will be 1 p.m., and our topic tomorrow is a special message to the African community. Please check that out, along with a discussion on the recent court decision on affirmative action. So what we're going to do right now, we're going to go back to playing some documentaries and share certain aspects and presentations of our history. And we'll be right back. So again, take out the pen and paper, take out some notes, and share it with your children. If they don't want to teach us, we must teach ourselves. This is MPH Radio. Let's talk a little bit about King James and the Black Kings. This is MPH Radio.
I know thy works and tribulation and poverty, but thou art rich. Welcome to the Black Excellence and Abundance Channel. King James, the first of England, who authorized the translation of the now famous King James Bible, was considered by many to be one of the greatest, if not the greatest, monarchs that England had ever seen. Through his wisdom and determination, he united the warring tribes of Scotland into a unified nation, and then joined England and Scotland to form the foundation for what is now known as the British Empire. At a time when only the churches of England possessed the Bible in English, King James' desire was that the common people should have the Bible in their native tongue. Thus, in 1603, King James called 54 of history's most learned men together to accomplish this great task. At a time when the leaders of the world wished to keep their subjects in spiritual ignorance, King James offered his subjects the greatest gift that he could give them, their own copy of the Word of the Most High in English. James, who was fluent in Latin, Greek, and French, and schooled in Italian and Spanish, even wrote a tract entitled Counterblast to Tobacco, which was written to help prevent the use of tobacco in England. King James was a king of Great Britain, Scotland, and Northern Ireland. King James was a black man, and the King James Bible is named after King James the First of England, who lived from June 19, 1566 to March 27, 1625. The established church was divided during this era. In 1603, King James called a conference in the Hampton Court in an attempt to resolve issues. As a result, a new translation and compilation of approved books of the Bible was commissioned to resolve issues with translations then being used. For example, the Geneva version contained controversial marginal notes that proclaimed the Pope was as an antichrist. The leaders of the church desired a Bible for the people, with scriptural references only for word clarification or cross-references. King James approved 54 scholars to work on the translation, and 47 worked in six groups at three locations for 7 years, comparing to previous English translations such as the Geneva Bible and texts in the original languages. The new translation was published in 1611 and called the Authorized Version because it was authorized to be read in the churches. It later became known as the King James Version. King James was the first to succeed in perfecting the English translation of the Bible. He successfully distributed around the world. King James gathered Hebrew, Aramaic, and Greek scholars who were also well-versed in the English language. Many among these scholars were black. Medieval Hebrew had been widely used by the Moors, along with Arabic because a large portion of the Moors were Israelites. The blacks of Scotland had Ethiopian Hebrew ancestry, and they shared the same history of the Hebrew monarchs of Ethiopia. King James himself could trace his ancestry to the tribe of Judah. The name James, meant to supplant, was interchangeable with the name Jacob. In Europe, the letter J was not used until the time of King James, whose team of scholars, who included some of Hebrew extraction, was responsible for its introduction in the English alphabet. Names like Judah and Jesus were pronounced as Yehuda and Jesus, respectively, until the time of King James. This is something that many of our subscribers and viewers of this channel have pointed out in previous videos in the comment section.
The King James translation had a significant influence on the English language and was widely accepted as the standard English Bible. Because of the project being overseen by King James and the care and precise attention to detail during this 7-year translation, the King James Bible was considered one of the most accurate translations in existence. This black king was the first to sit on three thrones at once, which was Scotland, England, and Northern Ireland. The King James 1611 Bible also included the Apocrypha. For various reasons, 14 books were subsequently taken out of the 1611 King James Bible. Thankfully, the 1611 King James Version is still available, which includes the Apocrypha. We would also like to point out that the Moors settled in Spain and Southern Europe in 711 CE. Significant numbers of black people found their way to Northern Europe countries such as Scotland, Ireland, France, and Denmark. Since the beginning of the first millennium, the nations of Scotland and Ireland had a significant number of blacks who in Scotland wielded political power as the kings and rulers. This is a little known fact in black history. In 1565, Queen Mary was married by her cousin, a black Scottish man of the royal family, who was called Darnley. Darnley was killed in 1567, but he had left the queen a male heir of her own lineage. Queen Mary's son, James, was born a few months before his father's murder. Thus, he became the first king of England. James VI was therefore the son of a black man and a colored woman. We often hear about black royalty in Africa, but it is a little known fact that there was actually royalty in Europe as well. Yes, folks, King James, the translator of the Bible, was a black man. Let me say, one of the translators of the Bible. As you know, the Bible has been translated many, many times, but the most popular version in use in America for many years has been the King James Version. His actual version was the King James 1611, which included the Apocrypha.
Thank you for allowing me to see myself the way you see me. Thank you.
This is the voice of MPH Radio. We welcome you back to a special program. We are telling our history, because if they don't want to teach in your schools, we will teach it on MPH Radio. Welcome back. And like always, we say this is a special program. We're making a special call out to our listeners, our supporters, and all people of goodwill. We're seeking your support by making a donation to MPH Radio. And you can do that by writing a generous check or money order to Missing Pages of History, Inc., P.O. Box 27782, Richmond, Virginia, 23261. Or you can send it by Zelle and make out to Missing Pages of History 1 at yahoo.com. If those methods are not available to you, please email us at mphradio@yahoo.com. And we'll find other alternatives how you can participate and be a supporter and make your donation to MPH Radio. We also want to remind you on tomorrow, January the 1st, we'll be on live at 1 p.m. And we speak to the theme, a special message to the African community in the U.S. That's right, there's a special message to the African community in U.S., along with a robust discussion on the recent decision as it relates to affirmative action by the U.S. Supreme Court. So join us tomorrow at 1 p.m., and you can do that by picking up your phone and dialing in at 1-818-337-0016, or go to Blog Talk Radio and type in missing-pages-of-history-inc. And join us. So again, we ask you to be generous with your donation by doing so right now. Take out your checkbook, your pen and paper, or take out your phone and make that donation come alive. We thank you for your support. Now let's continue to travel down the road of liberation by learning our history. We're going to talk a little bit about the whole history of origin of Hawaii and their so-called African kings. That's right, origin of Hawaii. This is MPH Radio.
I know thy works and tribulation and poverty, but thou art rich. Welcome to the Black Excellence and Abundance Channel. A little known fact, which I believe is deliberately ignored by modern anthropologists and historians, is that the natives of Hawaii, America's 50th state, were black people whose ancestry roots extended back to the continent of Africa. The story of black Hawaiians is one of the most intriguing of modern times. It is a tale of adventure and delight in paradise that turned into a cultural nightmare. It is one of America's best-kept secrets, and we must venture into antiquity to learn the roots of the black Hawaiians. This black culture once brightened the Pacific for over 2,000 years. Most anthropologists, paleontologists, and archaeologists around the world generally believe that human beings evolved on the continent of Africa from 3 to 5 million years ago, and that they eventually spread from Africa into Europe, Asia, the Pacific Islands, and finally the Americas. In time, these black settlers developed very advanced societies and sent navigators to explore and settle various islands of the Pacific Ocean. They reached such places as New Guinea, Fiji, New Hebrides, New Zealand, the Society Islands, Tahiti, Easter Island, and thousands more. The first people to reach what is now Hawaii were blacks from Polynesia. They sailed to Hawaii in great canoes about 2,000 years ago. The Hawaiians and their neighbors in the Pacific have long been the subject of controversy among scientists. The people in this part of the world are generally divided into three groups: Melanesians, who are an unmixed black people; Micronesians, which is also an ancient black group; and the Aboriginal Polynesians. All three groups are black people. The black people themselves are an ethnological puzzle. Many, like the Tasmanians, who were exterminated by English settlers, were pure blacks. the basic strain of the original Hawaiians as seen in their color and their faces, writes historian J. A. Rogers in the book Sex and Race, Negro-Caucasian Mixing in All Ages and All Lands, was undoubtedly Negro, with an admixture of Mongolian. These people were of black and brown complexions with wavy and close-curled hair, broad facial features, and fine physiques. In short, they had the same physical characteristics as millions of other people who now live in the Pacific Islands. Now this is a quote from the book by J.A. Rogers, Sex and Race. Negro-Caucasian mixing in all ages and all lands. According to one early legend, these early settlers named their home New Hawaii in honor of a chief named Hawaiʻiloa, who is said to have led the Polynesians to the islands. But the name Hawaii is also recognized as a form of Hawaiki, the legendary name of the Polynesian homeland to the west. The ancient island of Hawaii was much like an African society. It was a series of islands ruled by strong-willed chiefs or kings who believed that they had descended from God. A court genealogist similar to the African griot cited names, family exploits, battles, and past glories of a proud people and their royal leaders. Hawaiian life revolved around religious ceremonies. Believe it or not, folks, right here in America, there were many black African kings and queens in Hawaii. People like King Kamehameha, Queen Ka'ahumanu'umanu, King Kamehameha Halehaleho, King David Kalakalua, just to name a few. And there were plenty others. Closely linked to Hawaiian religious traditions was the kapu, or the law administered by the king. It was a rigid system of rules and guides, do's and don'ts, what's and what nots, governing events from lovemaking and marriage to the season for catching certain fish. It separated kings from commoners, men from women, and Hawaiians from foreigners. It was probably one of the most complex legal systems of the ancient world. If ever there was a paradise on earth, the Hawaiians appeared to have it. Blessed by a gorgeous climate, the people basked in the sun, swam in clear water, and participated in competitive games and sports. They worked in order to live, but there was a fine line between work and play. Fishing, for example, was as much as a water sport as it was a source of obtaining food. These industrious people shared their harvest so that no one was without food, and everyone found shelter in the marvelous huts built mainly from the leaves of palms and holly trees. The people worked, swam, sang and danced, isolated from most of the rest of the world, writes Maxine March in the book Hawaiian Monarchy, The Romantic Years. Yes, a monarchy right here in America, a black but unfortunately, that was soon to be changed. The garden would be discovered, gone would be the sunny, static days of peace and order. During those times, Hawaii was not ruled by a single king, but it was a chain of islands which included Kauai, Maui, Oahu, Molokai, Lanai, Niihau, and Kahoolawe. Each island was ruled by a different monarch, all black. The last native ruler of Hawaii was the celebrated Queen Liliʻuokalani. Following the Queen's ascension to the throne in January of 1891, a Chicago newspaper woman, Mary H. Kraut, described Queen Liliʻuokalani as strong and resolute. The features were strong, the complexion quite dark, the hair streaked with gray, and she had the large dark eyes of her race. The queen was a brilliant writer, poet, and composer who worked tirelessly for the welfare of her people. While she sought to strengthen the monarchy and to literally return Hawaii to the Hawaiians, the queen was years too late. American businesses and missionaries had strongholds in every corner of the Hawaiian culture. The queen stood steadfastly against the U.S. forces, but finally, in January of 1893, she yielded under protest and was recorded in the Pacific Commercial Advisor on January 18th as saying, "I, Lilia Lokolane, by the grace of God and under the Constitution of the Hawaiian Kingdom, Queen, do hereby solemnly protest against any and all acts done against myself and the constitutional government of the Hawaiian Kingdom by certain persons claiming to have established a provisional government of and for the kingdom. Now, to avoid any collision of armed forces and perhaps the loss of life, I do under this protest and impelled by said force yield my authority until such time as the government of the United States shall, upon the facts being presented to it, undo the actions of its representative and reinstate me in the authority which I claim as a constitutional sovereign of the Hawaiian Islands." So in 1893, she relinquished her throne to save her people and to preserve the islands. The United States never chose to undo the actions of its representative. In fact, in 1900, Hawaii had become a territory of the United States. And in 1959, Hawaii became the 50th state. In 1993, President Bill Clinton signed Public Law 103-150, which is a legislation apologizing for the U.S.'s role in the 1893 overthrow of the Kingdom of Hawaii. The apology, meant as a means of reconciliation with Native Hawaiians, acknowledges the historic significance of the event, but the apology did not provide federal recognition to Native Hawaiians as other federal laws provided to American Indians tribes. So basically it was lip service, but an acknowledgement nonetheless. From King Kamehameha to Queen Lili Lokelani, each Hawaiian ruler was very dark-skinned with Negro features. It is one of the incredible stories of history that few Americans are aware that the original Hawaiians were black people and that their royal family was one of the greatest of the 19th century. Right here in the United States.
Change? I guess change is good for any of us. Whatever it takes for any of y'all to get up out the hood. I'm with you. I ain't mad at you. Got nothing but love for you. Do you think, boy? Yeah. All the homies that I ain't talked to in a while, I'ma send this one out for y'all. Know what I mean? Cause I ain't mad at you. Heard y'all tearing up shit out there. Kicking up dust. Giving a mother up. Yeah, because I ain't mad at you. Now we was once two, the ends of the same time. Quick to holler at a hoochie with the same line. You was just a little smaller, but you still roll. Got stressed to Y.A. and hit the hood swole. Remember when you had a Jerry curl, didn't quite learn. On the block with your Glock, trippin' off Sherm. Collect calls to the tilt, saying how you changed. Oh, you a Muslim now, no more dope game. Heard you might be coming home, just got bail. Wanna go to the mosque, don't wanna chase tail. It seems I lost my little homie, he's a changed man. Independent now, no sinning, it's the game plan. When I talk about money, all you see is the struggle. When I tell you I'm living large, you tell me it's trouble. Congratulations on the wedding, I hope your wife knows she got a player for life. And that's no issue, I know we grew apart, you probably don't remember. I used to be for your sister, but never him for ever. And I can see it's after school, we bomb. On the first one, up with ums with the bomb. But it's on, now the whole issue changed. And we don't even kick it, got a big money scheme. And you ain't even with it, knew in my heart you was the same. Up with ums, get bad. Go toe to toe on the top of road, you got us brothers back. And I can't even trip, cause I'm just laughing at you. You trying hard to maintain, then go ahead, cause I ain't mad at you.
kicking some cats that's on the roof from behind the stairs. I'm getting blessed and I reminisce on all the time we said. Besides pumping and grinding wasn't nothing on our mind. In time we learned to live a life of crime. We grinded back to a time was much too young enough. I caught a felony loving the way the gun blow. And even though we separated, you said that you raised. Don't get nobody no cookie while I be locked up safe. I kiss my mama goodbye, wipe the tears from my lonely eye. Said I'd return, but I gotta fight to get survived. Don't shed a tear, cause mama, I ain't happy here. I feel trial, no more smiles for a couple years. They got me going mad, I'm knocking busters on their backs. In my cell, picking hell, I know one day I'll be back. As soon as I touch down, I told my girl I'll be there. So prepare to get up down. The homies wanna kick it, but I'm just laughing at you. Cause you's a down ass if it's I ain't mad at you. Well, Kevin's moving up, it's looking ballin' now. Give this bitch ballin' to get it. Look, look, he falling down. He went from nothing to lock. 10 cabins to rock. Went from a nobody nigga to the big man on the block. He's Mr. Local Celebrity. Addicted to moving G. Most hated by enemy. Escaping the luxury. See, first you was out working, but you made it. So the choice is made. Now we got who else, why you faded. In the younger days, so full of pain when the weapons blade. Getting so high off that bomb, hoping we make it to the better day. Cause crime pays, and in time, you'll find a rhyme ablaze. You'll feel the fire from the lickings in my younger days. So many changed on me, so many try to plot. But I keep a block to stop my head, when will it stop? Shall God return me to my essence? Cause even as an adolescent, I refuse to be a convalescent. So many questions and they ask me if I'm still down. I moved up out of the ghetto, so I ain't real now. They got so much to say, but I'm just laughing at you. And just don't know, but I ain't mad at you.
That's right, MPH Radio is not mad at you. This is a special program today on June the 30th. We're calling for all our listeners, friends, supporters, anyone who has a message to support MPH Radio by making a donation to MPH Radio by either Zelle, and you can Zelle to Missing Pages of History 1 at Yahoo, or send a general donation of a check or money order to Missing Pages of History, Inc., P.O. Box 27782, Richmond, Virginia, 23261. And we remind all of you, before we take this one phone call, that tomorrow we'll be having a live program on July the 1st at 1 p.m., same time, same station. You dial in at 1-818-337-0016. Dial in to listen in or call in, or you can go to Blog Talk Radio. .com/missing-pages-of-histories-inc. Tune in tomorrow. We have a special program where there will be a special message to the African community, as well as a robust discussion on the recent decision by the U.S. Supreme Court on this question of affirmative action. We're in process of making that final transition for today. Before we do that, this was a special program. Normally we don't take a call, but we do have a caller. On your last four numbers, 1650 caller, we'll let you make your comment, and then we'll be closing out for this special program and seeking support at MPH Radio. We've been listening to documentaries as relates to African people history. All these documentaries can be found on YouTube. We support the artists and the creators of these documentaries. We'd like to thank them, and one of the things we want to do at MPH Radio is to share the history of our people. So let's take this caller. Caller, your last four numbers, 1650. See what comments you'd like to make for today. Yes, caller, welcome to MPH Radio, 1650.
Hey, good morning, sir. Hey, how you doing? Hey, put that back in the refrigerator. I'm feeling good,
good morning,
bro. And then Pac is one of my favorite artists. I'm having a great day. I'm texting like 300 people and telling all my winning team members, come on in, man. I love the show. I've been listening for a long time. I said, today I'm going to call in. Bye-bye, baby. But, yeah, oh, man,
I'm so proud for you calling in. You like our show. We've been working for years to try to help our people. That's the only thing we can do. We owe that debt to those who came before us. So the best we can do is do those things to make life better for others. But we'll be on tomorrow live at 1 p.m. You can share that with your listening audience. Please tell them to call in on this number over the Blog Talk at 1 p.m. from 1 to 3 p.m. And also, email us and let us know who you are in terms of your email so we can stay in touch with you and share with you with the stuff we're doing. That we are doing, and we actually like for you to join us. We have open recruitment now. We're looking for supporters. We're looking for workers. We're looking for writers. We're looking for
I'm artists. Here to help, my brother. I can't send the email if I don't have the email to give. I need your email so I can send you some information.
I got to tell you what I do, my brother. If you give me permission to give you a call, I can give you a call
please.
Right after this program. Okay?
Hey, so absolutely. I'm going to be on to the end. Yes, sir.
All right, dear brother, we thank you very much. We can close out the program for the day. We thank you, my brother.
Amen. Thank you, bro.
All right. You listen to MPH Radio. It's a bi-weekly program that comes on every other Saturday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, U.S. It's a global radio station, and we came to existence because we want to use this as a tool for information to help liberate and make our community better. But we only can make it better is by having your support and your participation. So MPH Radio and MPH History, the organization, has an opening now. We are recruiting membership, supporters, and friends to come and help join us, help us build this institution worldwide, and help serve our people and our land, homeland, Mother Africa. And you can do that if you have interest. Just email us at mphradio@yahoo.com. Or you email us at missingpagesofhistory1@yahoo. Do one of the others, and we will get back in touch with you. We need your support. Again, you can support us by pledging and making a donation to Missing Pages of History, Inc., P.O. Box 27782, Richmond, Virginia, 23261. As well as, if you have a Zelle account, you can Zelle it to us by typing in missingpagesofhistory1@yahoo.com. If those methods don't work for you, again, email us at mphradio@yahoo, and we'll find another alternative how you can participate. So, again, we hope that the documentaries that you heard today, you can get again and check them out on YouTube, and we want to support all the artists and all the individuals and stories who are doing that kind of work. So until next time, we see you tomorrow, Saturday, July the 1st at 1 p.m. on this station at the same time. And we want to let everybody know that we have a responsibility not only to create and make our history and tell our history and preserve our history, but we must also do what? Fill in those missing pages of history. And that's what we are all about. So we'll see you tomorrow, Saturday, July the 1st at 1 p.m. And from Alisa Keys, we are here for all of you. Thank you if you take your time, take some time out to make that donation. We'll see you tomorrow. This is the voice of MPH Radio.
in the nation. We're no support for education. Cause right now it don't make sense. Right now it don't make sense. Let's talk about our part. My heart touch your heart. Let's talk about living. Had enough of dying. That's what we all about. Let's do more giving. Do more forgiving. Yeah. Our souls are brought together so that we could love each other. Sisters, we are here. We are here for all of us.
stand up for your rights. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your rights. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your rights. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight.
You can fool some people sometimes, but you can't.